Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live Chat Room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Informing, not boring. George Christensen on today's news talk radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the George Christensen Show here on TNT Radio. You know, the conservative pro-freedom movement, I think sometimes it mugs itself by its inability to properly communicate things. The left, and I was just speaking about this with Anita Donlan before, the environmental movement, for instance, they've been so good at creating myths. They create stories. They tell those stories. The stories tug at the heartstrings, and they con a lot of people into believing wrong things. They con a lot of people into doing particularly bad things. And, you know, the conservative movement, while we don't want bad things to happen, we could learn a lot from the left in terms of their persuasive ability. This brings me to my next guest. His name is Michael Gladkoff. Michael's been studying persuasive communication ever since the mid-1980s. He is a professional speechwriter. He's also a professional wordsmith. You can have a look at his businesses in copywriting and editing, Word Nerds, word-nerds.com.au. His speechwriting business at speechpower.com.au. But what we're going to be talking to Michael today is about speaking for freedom. You see, Michael was first inspired by the great communicator himself, former President Ronald Reagan. Now, he was inspired when he attended one of the campaign rallies for Reagan in San Diego, California, the evening before the 1980 US presidential campaign. And so that sort of says a lot, actually. As I said, Ronald Reagan was known as the great communicator, and I bet there's quite a few lessons that Michael derived from Ronald Reagan himself. But in addition to persuasive communication, Michael's had a lifelong interest in the politics and history of freedom, of liberty. This combination of interests and experiences led him to create Speaking for Freedom. It's a book. It's something that I know that Michael is wanting very much people to understand, Speaking for Freedom. The title of the entire book is Speaking for Freedom, Your Guide to Promoting Life, Liberty, and Limited Government. In addition to this book, Michael delivers keynote presentations, workshops, and all of this is to influence, inform, and inspire potential audience members to be more effective in promoting freedom, in promoting free speech, free society, free enterprise, the backbone of Australia, the backbone of the United States, the backbone of the West. And you can find more about that at www.speakingforfreedom.com. But we're going to find more about it now from the man himself. Michael, tell me why you got so passionate about the need for proper communication for freedom lovers.
Yeah, thanks, George. I'm glad to be here. I think because there really was, not a single source of this type of information. And I know there's a lot of books about speech writing and business and other areas. So how to be, more successful in sales or executive speaking. But this one looks at it from the perspective of freedom. So what I do is look at some of the great speeches from history and take lessons from those. So it's loaded with examples from people like Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, and even going back further back to people like Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. So really, I wanted to put it all in one place and really apply my lessons from writing hundreds of speeches for other people. A lot of these speeches were in business. I've done some in politics as well. But I think that, the basic formula is the same. And I think we can, really improve our game and really create more free societies the more persuasive we are.
Would you agree with my commentary at the start? The left loves to tell a good story. They are the great myth makers. But unfortunately, their stories, they're not like us. They don't go after the facts of the matter. What they'd like to try and do is tug at the heartstrings. And that works with a lot of people. We want to hear stories. We want to hear about how things affect other people. And I think that therein lies the secret to their success. They're great mythologizers. Would you agree with that, Michael?
Oh, definitely. And I talk about Aristotle in the book, and in his book, Rhetoric, he wrote about the three modes of persuasion, which are ethos, pathos, and logos. And ethos is the, your credibility, your image when you get on stage or on video. It's what people think of you, your history, your experience, how you're introduced if you're giving a speech somewhere. Your pathos, the pathos is the emotional part. So like you said, telling stories. And logos is logical. And Aristotle said that logos was the most important. And that's also, you know, the view of many people today that deal with persuasive communication. And in one book, it's called Descartes' Brain, but it mentions how when people have an injury to the part of their brain that regulates emotions, they have trouble making decisions. And from that, you know, they've concluded that we decide emotionally when we make a decision. So really, a lot of these emotional things that really help us make decisions, like stories. And that's why I think, people on the left are so successful. And one thing that about Ronald Reagan was he was a great storyteller. And that's how he was so successful and became be called the great communicator. And he learned that over many years. He started as a young person, radio announcer in his early 20s. And then he was an actor. Plus, he was a spokesman for General Electric. And he traveled the United States, and he collected stories from people and experience he saw about how government interference really makes our lives more difficult and less prosperous. And he started out as a New Deal, big government Democrat. And from his experience, he switched to the Republican Party when he was in his 50s. So he really was awakened by his experiences.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that Reagan would be the greatest communicator of the modern political age, or do you give that gong to someone else?
No, I give it to him, definitely, because he did things that were so different. For example, there's a State of the Union address in the United States, and probably Australians might not be as familiar with that, but it's given every year. And usually before Reagan, it was just a boring thing, a laundry list of achievements and goals. But Reagan brought in stories, and he actually he would tell a story of maybe somebody that rescued somebody or some heroic feat, and he'd actually bring that person to be in the audience, and he'd point him out during the speech and tell the story. So he made it an uplifting and motivational experience for the audience. And he told a story. So I think definitely his speeches, you see quoted things like Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall and evil empire. Just the language and the speeches are probably the most memorable, I'd say, in the last 100 years.
What would be Reagan's most memorable speech as far as you're concerned?
Well, I'd probably say the one in 1987, where he at the Berlin, Berlin Brandenburg Gates, where he told Gorbachev to tear down this wall. Because that really had a big impact. And also the other one was the Evil Empire speech, which he delivered in 1983. And a lot of people told him, don't say evil empire, don't insult people. But he had a strong belief in ending communism behind the Iron Curtain. And that went back to the 60s or even before that. So he had that strong belief, and that was his mission, most of his life, later life. So he felt that strongly, and that was really the start of the end of the Cold War. He was played a major role in that, along with people like Margaret Thatcher and the Pope at that time.
So let's move on to other political identities and just people in general in the conservative and libertarian movement. Who are some of the shining lights that you think we can learn from in terms of their ability to effectively communicate freedom and liberty?
Okay. I was even looking back, looking back 150 years ago or more, one was Abraham Lincoln. And his speeches, they weren't really storytelling. He loved to tell stories in small groups and in private groups and tell jokes, and he was very humorous. But his speeches the language was so just really metaphorical and descriptive. And he was highly influenced by what he read. And he would read the King James Bible. He would read Shakespeare. And he knew passages from Shakespeare that were minutes long that he could recite. He loved reading that so much. So that was one of the early ones. Not early going back, but more in the modern times. And then looking more forward, Winston Churchill, with his speeches during World War II, the famous speech that he gave after France fell, where he's talking about we shall fight them on the beaches and we shall fight them on the landing grounds. That's a famous quote that people remember. So he was very persuasive. And he used a lot of persuasive figures of speech, which I also talk about the book in the book. I cover over 30 of them. So things like antithesis, diacopy, these Greek words that we're not familiar with, but the one Churchill used in that speech was called anaphora, where you start each sentence with the same word or words, each mm-hmm. sentence or clause, and you have repetition. So he was a great rhetorician that way. And I read that he would spend about 2 hours on each paragraph that he wrote. So he spent a lot of time on his writing.
Yeah.
I mean, him being a writer, he did that himself. I know people like, Reagan in later years, he had a team of speech writers, but he learned the craft himself, and what he delivered at the end was highly influenced by his writing. He would go in and edit and change it. Another one that was a great speech writer and speaker was Margaret Thatcher. Mm-hmm. And she also wrote her own speeches. I have a little anecdote in my book about someone that was eating breakfast with her before one of the Conservative Party conferences where she was speaking, and she was there with a red pen crossing out things and changing things at the last minute. So she was very particular about what she said and how she said it. And me as a speech writer, I can see that, because I write a speech and then I mark it up, and I might change it 10 times before I have the final version ready, just to make sure every word is the way it should be for maximum impact.
Yeah. And in the Australian scene, what's your thoughts on some of the over the course of history, some of the speakers, some of the politicians and leaders we've had in this country, and their ability to communicate?
Yeah, well, one I really cover a lot in the book is Robert Menzies. And for those that don't know, if you're overseas, he was the prime minister longest serving in Australia. I think it was between like 1949 and 65.
That's right.
And so he really, he was a great speaker, and he really motivated people. And one of the speeches I really like, where he's really sort of energetic, was when they tried to nationalize the banks in Australia after World War II. And he gave a really strong speech at the town hall, but he's really known for his radio addresses. One was called The Forgotten People, which is his most famous. And I think that was 1943. And it just sort of a speech that honoring the middle class and the importance of having a strong middle class. And one of the things that he strongly believed in was simple language, plain and simple language. And he talked about one time, this one quote that I have from one of his speeches, where he talked about, you take 100 words from a parliamentary speech, and most of them are 2 to 3 syllables, and you take 100 words from the King James Bible, and 80% are one syllable. So he was a strong proponent of simple, strong, simple language that's easy to understand. And I think that's how he made such a big impact.
Yeah. Well, that the Forgotten People speech is certainly, one of those moments in Australian history that that isn't easily forgotten, because it really was a rallying cry to people at that time that were seemingly left behind, and Australia seemed to be slipping into a leftward trajectory, as we are today, back mm-hmm. then. And he was able to use this as the basis to rally a whole host of middle Australia together to the cause for freedom. So perhaps it's something that we need to revisit again in this day and age. What do you see in terms of this day and age and the people who we have doing the leading in the conservative movement there? Is there any bright lights in terms of communicators?
I haven't really, studied it that closely, but I think, there's been some good speakers recently, and, as far as following people, I think someone like, you know, Tony Abbott was a good, strong communicator in his speeches. Also, there's, you know, several people in Parliament. I think Malcolm Roberts, I enjoy his speeches. And Alex Antic.
Yes.
I think he's a very good speaker. I enjoy listening to his speeches. So, yeah, a few people like that, that I think are strong communicators that get their message across.
Yeah.
And I think they're effective that way.
Is there any defining trait from these people, the Tony Abbotts, the Malcolm Roberts, and the Alex Antics?
Well, I think just knowing how to combine what I talked about earlier, knowing how to combine the logic and the emotion and, having the authority. So I think that's important, how you combine those three things. And like I said earlier, that we decide emotionally if someone's going to persuade us, we do it emotionally. They say in sales that you buy emotionally and later on you justify rationally when you buy something. So I think it's really having the mix of that that makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to hear more about how effective communication can actually save freedom here on TNT Radio after this quick break.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
I actually think many of the voices we hear most frequently on the most high visibility mastheads and free-to-air channels are not actually speaking with their own voice. They are using their voice to express someone else's opinion. They are reading from some version of a cheat sheet. They are regurgitating talking points for someone else's vested interests. I'm not here to give you a sort of MI6 or ASIO generated daily narrative of how it is that black is in fact white, how love is in fact hate, and how truth is in fact a lie.
Ross Cameron on TNT Radio.
When you can point me to an industry, to a platform that reaches 250 million people a month, virtually 9 out of 10 Americans, that's real, that's substantive, that's important. And that reach and that touch point and that daily reinforcement, it's an amazing place to be able to communicate messages. That's massive.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
George Christensen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to TNT Radio's The George Christensen Show. Good to be with you. I'm joined for the next hour by Michael Gladkoff, who is a communications professional. He's written a book, literally written the book on speaking for freedom, which you can find on Amazon and through Michael's website, speakingforfreedom.com. And what he's talking about that in that book is the kind of skills, the kind of things that you need to promote life, liberty, and limited government, to promote, in other words, freedom. I think that something is essentially missing from the repertoire of a lot of leaders in the pro-freedom movement these days. And this is just important. I think it's very important. It's not just rhetoric that, although it is rhetoric that we're talking about, but it's not just talking, really. There's an old adage. It's been ascribed to many different people. Who knows who said it first? Some say it's something from the ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu. Some say it was with Mahatma Gandhi. But the whole saying is about your beliefs becoming words, or your beliefs rather becoming thoughts, the thoughts becoming words. And I think this is where words become very important, because words become actions, actions become habits, habits become values, and values becomes your destiny. And I think that the same can be said of nations and peoples and how they are guided and the words that are spoken by their leaders. So, Michael, I want to turn to the world today. Obviously, everyone's looking and wondering what is going to unfold in your former country, United States of America, over the course of the next year. We've got Joe Biden there as leader of the free world, and mate, he can hardly string a sentence together. And I don't really want to dwell too much on Joe Biden, because really, when you start dwelling on it, it becomes elder abuse. The reality, though, is that the next election looks like it is Donald Trump's for the taking once again. What do you, how do you measure Donald Trump's communication skills?
Okay, well, I think he has two different styles, really. And one is the more off the cuff style. And that's where he's speaking to an audience like a rally. It's probably a written speech, but he's sort of, giving his thoughts, and it's sort of casual, where he's connecting with the audience and he's talking about current events and he's getting them motivated. So I think he's very effective at that, and building a rapport with the audience, and really, using humor as well in a way that's, satire or humor. So he's really master at the art of the insult, basically. when he wants to knock somebody down,
he can be brutal. He can be very
exactly. I think that comes from his background in where he grew up in New York, because I've known people sort of from that area that are very similar. They have that really, really quick wit, and they can take someone on as far as an insult. So I think that way is it's very sort of extemporaneous and very effective. The other one is when something is written for him, it's more of a formal speech. And I think one good example of that was a speech he gave when he arrived in Poland and visited them in his first year as president. That was a very effective speech. That sort of, reminded me of something that Reagan would have done. It was, that very high style where there's a lot of stories. He talked about the Polish resistance during World War II. He talked about the history with, Pope John Paul II. So, and he talked about the heroes of that country. So he told stories. And he told about the connection between the United States and Poland, going back to the Revolutionary War, when there were some Polish people serving in the American Colonial Revolutionary Army.
Yeah.
So he really created that connection. And he didn't write that, but I think he probably had an input in that. It was written by speechwriters. So that's more of the formal style. And I think his speechwriters would do a very good job when they had something like that, of very formal speech. But otherwise, I think, his other style is more off the cuff, is more personal style. And I think they're both effective.
Yeah, yeah. I think that you're right. The off-the-cuff style seems to endear himself to the vast bulk of the American people, particularly that flyover country they have in the US. How do you think, though, Donald Trump's he's been something of a bit of a hand grenade to the establishment, to politics as usual, not just in the United States but right around the world. How does his style of communication reflect that? Does it reflect that, or are these two things separate?
No, I think it does. I think that he's willing to sort of, like I said, improvise and take people on. And he was very good at the debates. If you remember the presidential debates, he was always good at those. And I think Reagan was good at those as well. He had quick comebacks. So I think that's sort of his very style. And I think that the style of him speaking out as well, like he started speaking out about a lot of things that people were sort of afraid to speak out about. Before him, he sort of is the one that was on the vanguard of that, of some of the ridiculous things that are going on in society that he doesn't like, as far as things like not having a border or just letting criminals into the country and things like that, where he had a strong belief on that. So and also just the way that the economy was sort of set up against the United States, just by the way the trade has been set up, where United States has to give everything away basically to trade with other countries. So I think in that respect, he spoke out and he said things that really people, traditional Republicans before him, people like Mitt Romney, would never say. So I think a lot of people agree with him. So I think in that respect, he was outspoken, and like you said, it was sort of a hand grenade to a lot of people that didn't really expect that, but I think he sort of opened it up for people to be more outspoken in their beliefs.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was a speech that Donald Trump gave that they turned into an ad, actually, that was right before he first ran for the president, right before the first major election. And I had thought for a long while that Trump was likely to win that mm-hmm. presidential election, even while a whole heap of people were suggesting that there's no way he did. Just by the by, what did you think that he would win back then?
I thought he had a chance, but it just seemed like a lot of things was stacked against him. You know, a lot of the media, everything was stacked up against him, and revelations that came out, sort of little, you know, tricks that they had up their sleeve against him. So in the long run, yeah, I thought it would be close as far as, you know, what would happen. You know, in the primaries, you could see he was pulling ahead, and, you know, people were actually laughing. I think in a way they sort of wanted him, the opposition, the Democrat Party, they wanted him because they thought he'd be easier to defeat than other people.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think in a way they did some things that they were pushing for him in 2016 because they thought he'd be an easier one to defeat. So,
I think you're right on that front as well. And it was when they started throwing all of this stuff at him that I started to get a bit nervous, thinking that perhaps he might not get it. But then I saw this ad that he came out with, and the ad was a snippet of one of his speeches, and it definitely was not just one of those off the cuff things. It was a speech where he talked about the corrupt establishment and the elite, and he talked about how they'd rigged the system time and again for these people. And then he ended as saying that the greatest force that could upset these people was you, the American public. And I had never heard anything like this. This mm-hmm. was just a phenomenal speech. I think that as soon as I heard it, I knew this guy was going to definitely be the president, the next president of the United States of America, simply because he had that ability to take a very, very complex matter that most people just can't grasp. They can't grasp what is going on in their lives. And Trump summarized that, sheeted home the blame to a set of people, the establishment, the deep state, and he was bringing people along for the journey to the solution. And I thought that was not just clever, it was inspiring. And, I knew from that point on that Donald Trump would win the presidency. Are they the kind of speeches that take someone over the line, Michael?
I think so, yeah. And I think what you said about how he did that, but I also want to note that he was a negotiator for many years as a business person, and he still is, basically. And I think a lot of those skills come into being a good speaker as well, whether in politics. So I think that type of speech really can make a difference. And one example was when Ronald Reagan ran in 1976 and he was defeated by Gerald Ford, he gave a speech where, I know, I think he set the stage for, you know, being the next candidate and being a very strong contender in 1980. And also his speech, A Time for Choosing, which he gave in 1964.
Oh, brilliant.
Supporting Barry Goldwater. I think that was a seminal speech in the modern conservative movement where he entered the political scene. And at the end of my book, I go through that whole speech and I analyze it in terms of, you know, the emotion, the logic, and the and the authority, the credibility that I talked about earlier from Aristotle. And I make notes about each point where he uses those. Yeah, so I think that speech made a big difference. You know, that really changed the atmosphere. And after that, you know, there were the Nixon years, but I think that sets a stage for Reagan to come in 1980. So yeah, speeches like that can make a big difference as far as changing the world and changing how people think.
Indeed, I think that speech, A Time for Choosing, which most people title it these days, is it probably changed the course of American and world history. That And that's why I say that words can be incredibly, incredibly powerful, because, you know, when it's coming from the leader of that country, they can change the direction of a nation. They can change the psyche of a nation. And I think that's part of what you get at when you are talking about being able to communicate for freedom. It's not just about getting elected. It's about changing hearts and minds. So that's critical when it comes to speeches, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I know there's a lot of stuff these days where, you know, people have YouTube videos where they sort of just get on there and speak, you know, off the cuff, basically. But, you know, these great speeches, you know, the ones from, you know, Churchill or Lincoln or Thatcher or Reagan, they were written, you know, a lot of thought and art went into those. They were written carefully, and a lot of time was spent on them, and they include things, you know, like the stories that I mentioned. It had to be researched, and they include the figures of speech, persuasive language that I mentioned earlier. So really, you know, I know there's some people that can, you know, speak well extemporaneously, but I think really when the, you know, when the chips are down and you have a very important speech, whether it's a campaign speech or a very important video you want to make for YouTube, like actually sitting down and writing and really thinking out the speech and writing it is, you know, makes a tremendous difference.
I agree that, and some of these speeches don't actually have to be long speeches. I mean, one of the famous speeches that changed the course of the United States was obviously the Gettysburg Address.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
That was a very, very short speech. People don't realize that. Well, it was a very short speech.
Yeah, I think it's around 2 minutes. It's only a few hundred words. And interesting, like I said before, that I think 80% of the words are one syllable. It's very simple as well. And the story behind that was that Lincoln was invited to speak sort of as an afterthought. And it was another man speaking. His name was Edward Everett, and he was a senator at the time. And he was known for his great oratory. And he spoke for an hour and a half. and that speech is not remembered at all. I mean, he went on and on. And the Lincoln speech that was written, you know, sort of written down, of course, but was very short, was the one that people remembered in history.
Yeah, yeah. There is another leader who's just popped up. That is Giorgio Meloni, who is the now Prime Minister of Italy. And again, one of those sort of defining speeches that I thought popped out and just struck you very deeply. She spoke about, I think it was the identity. And she was talking about how there's this reductionism, identity politics in the modern era, and she railed against it. And I just want to read this bit from her speech and just get your reaction to it. You probably saw it, Michael, but this is a speech. She says, or a section thereof, I should say, everything that defines us now. I'll start again. I've already stuffed up the speech and I've only just started it. Everything that defines us is now an enemy. So they attack national identity. They attack religious identity. They attack gender identity. They attack family identity. I can't define myself as Italian, Christian, woman, mother. No, I must be citizen X, gender X, parent one, parent two. I must be a number, because when I am only a number, when I no longer have an identity or roots, then I will be the perfect slave at the mercy of financial speculators. That line from a very long speech that she gave actually just set people's hair on fire. I mean, it set the hair on fire of all of her conservative supporters. It set the hair on fire of the left, who said, "Oh, this is some fascist rising up again." And eventually, she's now the Prime Minister of Italy. What is it that she said there that makes it so powerful?
I think, for one thing, looking at it from a rhetorical perspective, at the beginning she uses that repetition, you know, the what I talked about, the anaphora, like Winston Churchill did in his speech, "We shall fight them on the beaches." There's a few of those sentences that are repeated, so I think that's effective. But then she gives examples, you know, she gives examples of all the points that would people can relate to that they've been so offended by, or just really things that are really that people are concerned about, those points that you mentioned. And I think it's good to give examples like that. One example of a speech that I write about and I really like was Charlton Heston's speech about political correctness that he gave in 1999.
Yeah.
And this is before, our time, when it just off the charts as far as political correctness. So he was warning about it back then. But he gives examples of, he gives like a laundry list of things that things of political correctness in a very short space of time, like she did, of the issues that she's talking about. So I think having those issues sort of bunched together right there in one place gets people thinking, gets them emotionally involved and thinking, because they're solid examples that affect people.
Yeah.
From that. So I think that makes it effective.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we are going to be back after this quick break to hear more about how you can actually speak for freedom with Michael Gladcloth here on The George Christensen Show on TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Head for the Costco and stock up on toilet paper. Darona is coming. Darona is coming.
Just in time to gin up fear for the weak-minded to queue up to get the latest round of COVID-19 boosters, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have announced that they're tracking a new, highly mutated lineage of the virus that causes COVID-19. The World Health Organization has said that it has classified BA.2.86 as a, quote, variant under monitoring, end quote, due to the large number of mutations it carries. The fact that there is a subsequent variant that has more mutation than earlier variants should come as no surprise to anyone who understands even the rudiments of virology. That's what viruses do. They mutate over time, becoming less virulent and less of a concern. But no, the fear porn mongers are going to be saying that you need to get your COVID booster to protect yourself against this new deadly variant, when in actual fact, the upcoming injections target the previous variant, meaning those injections will provide little, if any, protection against this new variant, which, if you get it, you'll likely get a head cold. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
I'm just texting him back.
I'm just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Thanks for listening and being part of the George Christensen Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the George Christensen Show here on TNT Radio. We're speaking with Michael Gladcloth, who's written a fantastic book, Speaking for Freedom. You can find more about that at speakingforfreedom.com. The book is all about how you can use persuasive communication to promote life, liberty, and limited government, all of the good things in life. Michael, for today, I mean, we look around us, the left is on the ascendancy, at least they are in Australia, they are in the USA as well. Here in Australia, it's wall-to-wall left-wing Labor government. Sadly, our conservative parties sometimes just become pale imitations of the left-wing Labor Party. We have a whole host of different diabolical sort of policies that are going to drop out on us. I mean, the government's promoting this divisive and woke voice referendum at the moment, which threatens to split the country in two. There's proposals for things that will upset our privacy, such as the digital identity system, central banking digital currencies. Now they're even talking about having a misinformation and disinformation law that will censor what you post online. When you look at all this, you think, boy, oh boy, oh boy, we need a resurgence in Australia for the spirit of freedom, for the defense of freedom and the promotion of freedom and liberty. For people out there that want to put a bit of fire in the belly of their fellow Australians, to wake them up, to get them to love liberty and love freedom once again and want to defend it, what are the things that you would say that people need to do to start better communicating for freedom?
Yeah, for one, I would say stories, definitely, because I know, for instance, the issue of climate change and how they're trying to shut down the energy supply in Australia. Prices are going up. The gas price is supposed to go up by $1,000 next year for the average consumer. And, instead of talking about the facts, but, create scenarios about, what life will be like under their system, under these results. So, tell a story, maybe hypothetically, about, the person that's, freezing in their house, in Melbourne or Tasmania or somewhere else where it gets colder in Australia, that type of thing, where you have solid things. Because I know they talk about, try to argue the facts of things like climate change, but I think when people see what their life will be like under these policies and have solid examples, I think that's really one way to show people. And the other way is to show people just the parallels from history. So that's why in my book I say, read history. And an example I give is, he was a speechwriter named James Humes, and he wrote for quite a few presidents. And he met Churchill when he was, Winston Churchill, when James Humes was a young man. And Churchill told him to study history, really, to be a great speechwriter. So knowing history, showing people that, this is what happened in, this is what happened in the Soviet Union when they tried to, create an edict about how people should run their lives, which yeah. reminds me of the, Victoria, where you can't have a gas connection to a new home, just having an edict without any consultation or people talking about it. But, you're not going to have any gas heating or cooking in your home, in a new home in Victoria. I mean, that's, those things we saw, earlier in the 20th century, unfortunately. So, teaching people that, history does sometimes repeat itself and we need to be very careful. The other thing is, using persuasive language. And I mentioned earlier figures of speech. So things like rhymes, rhymes are very effective way to create slogans that can motivate people. Like, for example, Reagan said, they have a kind of layaway plan for your lives, which never changes. Americans make, government takes. So it rhymes yeah. like that. So yep. things like that. And also looking at things, always there's things like, I have a whole list of these in my book. The one called the rule of three, where you repeat three elements, and that's very effective for persuasion. And that goes back to the ancient Greek. It's Greeks, and the official name is trikolon. So things like Margaret Thatcher said, Soviet Marxism is ideologically, politically, and morally bankrupt, using those three adjectives. Mm. Or Reagan said, freedom leads to prosperity. Freedom replaces the ancient hatreds among nations with comity and peace. Freedom is the victor. So having those three elements. Those type of things, that type of persuasive language, learning that and applying that, I think can be very effective of, a way of doing that. As I said earlier, telling stories. And also, if you're speaking to a group or a video, is, gaining the rapport with your audience is also very effective. And Ronald Reagan was a master of that. So he'd speak at a group, and he'd always have a joke that tied into that group. So he'd always, say something that was funny that related to that group or related to himself in some way. So he connected with them right away. Yeah. Or a story as well. He'd tell a story. So knowing how to connect in the beginning, and if you're giving a speech, presentation, video, even an article, connecting with people in a way that, gets them emotionally involved and shows that you think about the audience. So things like that, using those type of techniques. And of course, stories, the emotional part, telling stories about how these crazy policies are going to affect people in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Really nice. I think that's sort of why people talk so much about things like Orwell's 1984 or Brave New World.
Yes.
And, you know, I reread Brave New World a few weeks ago, and I read it earlier, probably 10 or 12 years ago. And, it blew my mind just how many of the things in Brave New World are going on today in the last 5 years that are being implemented. So it's pretty scary. So
it is very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary.
So you can mention things like that, you know, the way those ideas, those very detrimental policies are affecting our society, and telling stories about that.
On a bit of a philosophical level, as someone whose, profession and art is speechcraft, how do you feel about, you know, you just talked about it, you read 1984, you can see some of what was written about in dystopian science fiction becoming a reality. There are now a myriad of attempts and pushes to actually do away with elements of free speech, to crimp and control. As someone, as I said, whose lifeblood is speechcraft, how do you see this?
I'm very opposed to it. You know, and I think in any free society, we should always have a debate about ideas. And trying to shut down that debate, I think it only shows the weakness of, you know, the other side, what they're trying to do. They don't want to have a debate. So they just call it hate speech, or they call it misinformation. But they're just saying that they really don't have a strong argument, because that never happened before. And, you know, when I was growing up in the United States, there was, of course, Republicans and Democrats. And my parents, you know, we knew people of both parties, and we'd have them over for dinner at our house, and people would just talk. You know, they might debate or discuss ideas and politics, but it was never like people saying that, you know, you're a Nazi, or your ideas are misinformation, things like that. So I think that's a new thing that's come up. And, it's sort of it's scary, because it's a way to create a one-party state when you do something like that. Like we saw, in the Soviet Union and in Germany in the 1930s, where you can't express an idea. You're told that it's, bourgeois, or, capitalist, or, something that just saying your ideas is one thing by mentioning it. So I think in that respect, it's very dangerous for a free society when we can't debate and discuss our ideas and be told that they're disinformation or misinformation.
Yeah, yeah. Has part of the problem become that, the fact that in times past there was a lot of great oratory that was part and parcel of the political landscape, but now there's obviously the soundbite on what is a very fast-paced news cycle, and then there's also diminishing returns on social media, where everything's got to be quick and snappy. Has this made the art of speech, in terms of communicating freedom, more difficult, Michael?
I think it has in a way, but at the same time, if you can master those, those media, things like social media, and video as well. So my book is more focused on speech writing, because that's my area, and I look back to ancient history. But all these ideas can be applied in creating a video, creating a meme, as I spoke about earlier, using that persuasive language to create a meme, or anything else that you can use to cut through that. So I think in a way, we've changed the way we interact and what we see, because before everything was filtered through either a newspaper or, evening news or something, but now it's just in front of us all the time. But I think we still need to use those tools and use them even more to be effective and cut through, make a difference.
Yeah, yeah. So how, let me give you a real life scenario. We've got this voice referendum that's breathing down our necks. The Prime Minister's soon going to announce a date for this voice of the Australian Parliament to be decided by the Australian people. But if you were in the shoes of someone having to communicate why this proposal was such a bad idea, And I'm putting you on the spot. I don't expect that you're going to just suddenly develop the perfect speech. But what are the points that you would argue, Michael, if you were indeed a politician or someone who is wanting to show to people, particularly those sitting on the fence, that this is going to be a bad idea for the Australian nation?
Yeah, I think for one, like I said before, looking at history. So what happens when we try to divide people, no matter how, you know, how well we thought of our idea or how altruistic we thought it was. So trying to divide people and put them into groups. And the other thing is that I've heard about recently quite a bit is, you know, something similar that was done in New Zealand, you know, and all the problems that it has caused as far as for their society. So using a concrete example like that's more recent, you know, talking about that. The other thing is also the way it's presented, the fact that, you know, we don't know the facts. We don't know how it's going to work. It's very vague, you know, that type of thing. So finding examples or ways to refute that or rebut it by just showing that, you know, it's not really well thought out and the potential problems it can cause. And of course, we know about the laws in Western Australia recently that were repealed. That's one example of, you know, something that's gone wrong, you know, an altruistic thing, legislation that's gone wrong. But in this case, you won't be able to repeal it because it's a referendum that changes the constitution. So I would emphasize that, you know, this is set in stone. So think very hard about what you want to change and the potential ramifications before you make a decision on something that you know very little about and that's being very little is being told to us. So I would use those arguments, both sort of logical and emotional. And create a hypothetical scenario, you know, of a potential thing that could happen in the future. So, you know, maybe like what happened in WA, Western Australia, with the land where you needed a consultant to come in to dig a small hole when you had, I think it was like a quarter acre block or something, you know, an Aboriginal expert to come in and tell you whether or not you could do something to your own land, which is a potential of something like this to happen nationally.
Crazy stuff. It seems even with recent examples like that, it's a wonder that we have to properly communicate to other people about why this would be a bad idea. But nonetheless, we do. I want to go back to that Trump speech because I've actually just found it. And we've only got a few minutes left. So I'll end on this just to get your view on what he's done well here, and I'll have to go through this quickly. He says, our great civilization here in America and across the civilized world has come upon a moment of reckoning. We've seen it in the United Kingdom, where they voted to liberate themselves from global government and global trade deals and global immigration deals that have destroyed their sovereignty and have destroyed many of those nations. But the central base of world political power is right here in America. And it is our corrupt political establishment that is the greatest power behind the efforts at radical globalization and the disenfranchisement of working people. Their financial resources are virtually unlimited. Their political resources are unlimited. Their media resources are unmatched. And most importantly, the depths of their immorality is absolutely unlimited. He says, the corrupt political establishment is a machine. It has no soul. I knew these false attacks would come. He's talking about the personal attacks on him before the election in 2016. I knew this day would arrive. It's only a question of when. And I knew the American people would rise above it and vote for the future they deserve. The only thing that can stop this corrupt machine is you. The only force strong enough to save our country is us. The only people brave enough to vote out this corrupt establishment is you, the American people. What's he done there, Michael?
Yeah, I think he's created a, you know, common goal by talking about our civilization and talking about, you know, to the American people, and also so putting them all in the, you know, that we're in this together, and then talked about the problem. So like I said, he's talked about the problem and given several examples. Plus he's used some rhetorical devices in there where he repeats things at the beginning, sometimes at the beginning of a sentence, sometimes at the end of a sentence. So that's very powerful. The one, like I said, anaphora earlier is a rhetorical device, and epistrophe. Yes. It's called epistrophe, where you repeat something at the end of a sentence or a clause, and he uses that a few times. So those are very powerful. But, you know, he talks about, then he directs people, speaks to people directly by saying you. So you know, what's called a second person speaks to the audience directly. So I think that, you know, that in that way, it's very powerful. But like I said earlier, he gives a lot of examples. You know, he describes what the problem is, you know, who's the problem coming from, what the problem is, and
that it's really a problem, you know, for all of us as a society, speaking directly to the people that are impacted by it.
Fantastic. Well, we've almost just about hit the top of the hour. I want to plug your works. If you are interested in learning about Speaking for Freedom, The Leader's Guide to Promoting Life, Liberty and Limited Government, go to speakingforfreedom.com. The book is available on Amazon. You can also contract Michael to be a speechwriter, speechpower.com.au, and he also runs a copywriting and editing service at word-nerds.com.au. Thank you very much, Michael, for coming and talking to us about persuasive communication for freedom.
Thank you, George. I really enjoyed it.
Been terrific.
We're great.
Yeah. Be back after this news headlines here on TNT Radio for the final hour of the George Christensen Show.